Pope's exhortation is called the joy of the gospel. And the joy that Jesus says at the Last Supper, that he wants us to have his joy, somehow we've got to come to see, which we do, but that the joy that Jesus had, he still had on Calvary. So we're not talking about happiness. I don't imagine he felt very happy on the cross. We're talking about something far more profound that was to do with Jesus' communion with his Father that sustained him and gave him a profound joy that enabled him to be so positive and beautiful and everything that we see on Calvary. So that's the joy I want and you want. So we've got to talk about suffering. We have to see, what is this suffering? Why is it so central in Christianity in a way and in life? And how do we deal with it? What are the graces in it and so on? So that's our topic for now. You've got a little icon in front of you there with Jesus on the cross and Mary and the beloved disciple there sustaining him, and he's sustaining them, and they're sustaining each other in this dreadful scene, but there's love there. Paul writes in 2 Corinthians 4, we carry with us in our body the death of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus too may always be seen in our bodies. St. Peter, 1 Peter chapter 4, rejoice, he says, here it is, rejoice insofar as you're sharing Christ's sufferings, so that you may also be glad and shout for joy when his glory is revealed. So let me read from the exhortation of Francis. Number 6 reads, joy adapts and changes, but it always endures. Even as a flicker of light born of our personal certainty that when everything's said and done, we are infinitely loved. There's the key, obviously. I understand the grief of people who have to endure great suffering, says Pope Francis. Yet slowly but surely, we all have to let the joy of faith slowly revive as a quiet yet firm trust, even amid the greatest distress. Then he quotes, and it's a wonderful quote, if you're ever feeling down, and I presume you are sometimes, for God's sake, go and read the third lamentation. It goes down so deep in grief. Oh, it's overwhelming. You think, oh, I thought I was in a bad place. Whoever wrote this was really, really, really. And it goes right down into grief. And then something happens, the third lamentation, and it rises right up again. And this is the turn. I won't read you the whole thing, I'll just read the bit he quotes. My soul is bereft of peace. I've forgotten what happiness is. But this I recall to mind. Therefore I have hope. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. Every morning they are renewed. Great is your faithfulness. It's good to wait in silence for the Lord to save. And in number 276 of the same exhortation, the Pope continues, sometimes we're tempted, just see if this is true for you, it's obviously true for him, sometimes we're tempted to be that kind of Christian who keeps the Lord's wounds at arm's length. Yet Jesus wants us to touch human misery, to touch the suffering flesh of others. He hopes that we will stop looking for those personal or communal niches which shelter us from the maelstrom of human misfortune, and instead enter into the reality of other people's lives and know the power of tenderness. Whenever we do so, our lives become wonderfully complicated and we experience intensely what it is to be a people, to be part of a people. Written obviously from his pastoral experience and yours and mine, but he's trying to get us to share that, to live. Okay, the man who founded our religious order, you can tell me later about the wonderful Scalabrini, but Jules Chevalier was the founder of the MSCs, and in 1900 he wrote this, well, it had been, by that time he was 70-something, he wrote a big book on the Sacred Heart, 1900, and it included this wonderful dream. From the heart of Jesus, pierced on Calvary, I see a new world coming forth, a great and life-giving world, inspired by love and mercy, a world which the church must perpetuate on the whole earth. I'm sure that fits with your spirituality as well. That's the dream. Paul to the Galatians once again. I now live in faith, the faith of the Son of God loving me and giving himself for me. I cannot give up God's gift. You might notice that I've retranslated that little verse. Nearly all the books that I can find sound like this. I'll read it to you. They say, I now live by faith, faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. Now that's a possible translation of the Greek, but so is mine. And I think mine is far more profound and actually what Paul is trying to say. Go back quickly, and I'll bid not delay on this, but at the time of the Reformation, you know, the big argument. They said that the Catholic Church never taught it, but it practiced it a fair bit, and I can't blame people for looking at it that way. You had to do this to get saved. You had to do this to get saved. You did all your indulgences to get people out of purgatory. You know the kind of story. In other words, works. It wasn't the church teaching, but a lot of us were doing it, thinking we had to earn salvation. So what did the Reformation people say? No, no, no. It's not works that you need to get salvation. It's faith, your faith. Your faith in him, in Jesus. So instead of doing this, doing works, do this, have faith in Jesus. They're both wrong. Paul wasn't saying either of those things. He was saying something that's beautiful, profound, and once I say it, you'll say, of course. It's the faith of the Son of God that is gifted to us. Something we receive. That's what we get when we're baptized. We share Jesus' life, his heart, his spirit, his Father, his agenda, his mission, his faith. That's what we're going to watch in this talk a lot. It was the fact that Jesus kept believing in God. Now, I can't do it the way he did it, but we're not asked to. Jesus didn't say at the Last Supper, I'm a vine, I'll show you how to be a vine. Imitation of Christ, as it were. No, no, no. He said, I'm the vine, you're the branches. Cling to me and sure, you'll bear much fruit. Let me give you, Jesus is saying equivalently, let me give you my faith. gift to you. And you can have my faith in the Father. That will be what gives you joy, and that will be what gives you love, and that will sustain you. Paul's saying, what I'm living in now is faith. What faith? His faith in his Father. The faith, the Greek, if you know Greek, is just the genitive. It's a perfect translation. The gift, what kind of faith? The faith that something to do with the Son of God. The faith of the Son of God. His faith. At least that's how I think it's meant to be understood. John chapter 8, when you've lifted up the Son of Man, then, there's the cross there, the mystery of it all, then you'll know that I am. It's all the Greek says, it doesn't say I am he, or I am, just I am, ego eimi. That's take you back to the burning bush. Who are you? And God says it in Greek, the Greek translation, ego eimi ho-on. We talked about that last night. Ho-on, the one. I am. Well, Jesus says, I am. He's totally identifying with Yahweh, the Redeemer God. When you lift up the Son of Man, then you'll know that I am and that I do nothing on my own. They're accusing him of claiming to be equal to God. And he's saying, oh, for heaven's sake, God, everything I've got comes from God. I'm not equal with God. I'm not reaching up and grasping at equality. Everything I do comes from my Father, and I'm living it and loving it, and it's all dependent on him, as you know, perfectly faithful and humble and dependent and joyful. And so I can do nothing on my own, he says. I'm not another God, in other words. We haven't got three gods. Though sometimes the Muslims, when they look at Christianity, that's what they think, and maybe it's our fault. And they think we've got three gods, and they find that horrific. Of course they do, so do you. We're monotheists, there's only one. Then you've got the whole mystery of the Trinity, which of course I won't speak about now. I may later, but I do nothing on my own. I speak these things as the Father instructs me. And the one who sent me is with me. He hasn't left me alone. I always do what pleases him. That phrase will come back into the Last Supper, John's account, when Jesus says, you'll all leave me and you'll leave me alone. You'll be scattered. But he says, it's okay. I'm never alone. The Father is always with me. That's we're now at the very core of what the joy of the gospel is. We don't want to always be on crosses, of course, but if we are, joy can sustain us. I grew up a long time ago now, but maybe you did too. I grew up, I'm sure I was told in school, and probably from the pulpit, that God organised the crucifixion to save me. You must have heard something like that in your theology. It was a crazy theology, but that might have been the way they were saying it. Well, I just want to insist as closely as I can, and you'll know this already, but let me just push it hard. The crucifying of Jesus was a mortal sin, obviously, an unjust act of crucifying an innocent man. Well, now, if God organises mortal sin, then we're lost. We've lost the plot. Everything's gone. And we don't know what we're talking about. So, crucifying Jesus was something that was against the will of God. It has to be, just as it still is. Condemning an innocent person to death. Well, God, that's totally against anything that God does, love does. And just to back it up, in case you need it, Mark chapter 12, this is Jesus' own parable, which is giving us a bit of an idea of the way he looked at his dying, that he could see coming because he can see the vultures circling around him and ready to come in. And he tells this story, which you know. The owner of the vineyard, you know, he sent in this bloke and they bashed him up and another one they killed. And it says, the owner of the vineyard still had one other, a beloved son. So finally, he sent his beloved son to them, to us, to the world. Surely they respect my son. Okay, if they didn't listen to Isaiah, well, maybe there are reasons for that. And if they didn't listen to Jeremiah, well, I guess you could, you know, if they didn't listen to Amos, you know, well, you know, whatever, God's saying this, I'm imagining God saying this. But for heaven's sake, they've got to listen to my son. He's going to be so full of love, so caring, so all-embracing, that everyone will say, this is what we're waiting for, and they'll grab it the way many did. Surely they'll respect my son. But, says Jesus, what happened? The tenants said to one another, this is the heir, come, let's kill him, and the inheritance will be ours. So they seized him, killed him, and threw him out of the vineyard. In the light of the crucifixion of Jesus outside the wall of the city, you can see the early church, when they told this story, they, of course, that's part of it for them now, however, but they're the words of Jesus' parable. The really bit that can put us off the track is the story of the agony in the garden. And now I've got that for you. There's plenty of other texts I could give you and I won't. They're all in my commentaries, but I won't do it now. You know the story of the agony. Let's look at it again and see if we can see it with fresh eyes a bit. Jesus prayed, Abba. That's the Aramaic word for dad. Abba. Father, translation into Greek. For you all things are possible. Remove this cup from me. So it's quite clear Jesus doesn't want to die. Of course he doesn't want to die. He's 36 or 35 or who knows, he's in your middle 30s. And he was sent to do something and it hasn't been done. I mean, it doesn't look like it anyhow. No one's made much a difference. And then he says, but I don't want my will to be done. I want yours. So, the mathematicians among us, QED stuff, we think, oh, well, yeah, I understand that. Jesus is saying, I don't want to die, but you want me to die, so I'll die. That makes kind of logic, but it doesn't make sense. Could I imagine, and I'm only imagining, I'll just paint the picture for you again. What about if Jesus is in this agony and the one thing he's absolutely certain of is that his father's not behind all this stuff? That was old theology. God was behind the destruction of Jerusalem. God was behind the death of this person. God was behind lepers being cast out in the old Torah. God was behind everything. But Jesus knew better than that. He knew that sin raises its ugly head and does a hell of a lot of things that are against the will of God. That's what sin is. And the world has got beautiful things happening when people listen to God and ugly things happening when we sin. We all know that. So what about if Jesus is... One thing he's certain about is that something's gone wrong. Here he is. He was sent to do what? To love. To give his life. That doesn't mean die. It means give your life. And eventually you might have to do it when you're dying. But give your life. Love is what giving life is. Like mums and dads and priests and uncles and aunties and catechists and everything all over the world. He knew that. But when he looked at his world, you know it as well as I do, he must have felt that he'd failed. Okay, there was Mary of Magdala kind of thing and it looked pretty good there. But the Pharisees were still the same, the high priest was still the same, the Roman soldiers were still doing the thing, the Sicarii were in there trying to knife Roman soldiers and getting their country swamped with military stuff that was too big for them, and the people were as fickle as fickle. Last Sunday they said, oh, welcome, see who comes in the name of the Lord, but Friday hasn't come yet, but gee, they're easily persuadable when they are fearful like every crowd. So, what's good? The apostles aren't ready. He can tell they're not ready yet. They love what he's saying and they're nearly there and they're trying to hold it, but it's slipping out of their fingers. In other words, he must have felt, I'm presuming this, that he hadn't, something had gone wrong. Was he thinking, maybe I shouldn't have emptied the temple the way I did? I don't know. Was he thinking maybe I shouldn't have come to Jerusalem so early? I should have given him more time. Maybe when I said, "Woe to you, Pharisees," maybe I lost my block, but you know, pretty well. I don't know what he was thinking. Of course, you know I don't. But this is the bit, not my will, but thine be done. He came to a point I've got to come to, and you've got to come to, and we've all got to come to, and it's the source of joy. He came to the point we've all got to get to, where he knew that the best thing he could do would do the will of God, meaning keep loving no matter what. Keep confronting the establishment of the synagogues, etc., no matter what. Keep embracing lepers, no matter what. Keep caring for the sinners and loving them into life, not condemning them in it. It's easy to do. But love them out of it. So he was going to carry on the mission of his Father, which was to reveal God as love. So with that strength, Jesus rose from the agony, not knowing, of course, what was going to happen. Captured that night, that looked as though it was probably going to happen, but Pilate could have changed his mind. The high priest could have been converted at the last minute. Why not? Anything could have happened. But that's not Jesus' business any more than it is ours. His conviction, beautiful one, was to want what God wants and to do it whatever the cost. You see some of that at the Last Supper, which is just before the agony, as you know. Jesus is there. It's not a Passover meal, technically, because that's going to happen the next night, according to John's timing, and John's no doubt right. Because there's no Paschal lamb at the meal. There is, but it's Jesus. So it's a simple meal held the night before the Passover because he can see maybe we won't be here tomorrow night. Things are getting very tight and narrowing in, and he can see the eyes and he can see Judas, whatever. So this night he's there at the meal, which we've had today. And when he broke the bread, which he always did, something in here broke. And he said, "This is my body, and I give it for you. Do this in remembrance of me." Do what? What's the this in that sentence? Do this, yes, we can understand it to mean go to Mass on Sunday, keep having the ritual of the Mass going. And of course it does mean that, and it's lovely, and we do it, and it's part of our heart, and everything's beautiful. But there's more to it than that. And John brings it out in his account of the Last Supper, which he doesn't mention these words, he takes that for granted as known by everybody. John has Jesus washing their feet, and he says, "Do this in memory of me. Wash each other, do what I'm doing. Give your body to others in love, even if it breaks. Even if they pierce your heart, let blood and water fall out. Do what I'm doing. Pour your life out for other people." In other words, love one another as I have loved you. That's the doing. And then you express it all here, of course, beautifully in the Mass. It's when we look upon the one we've pierced that we come to see that the power of God is not in the sphere of control, but of love. He is Jesus. Yeah, sadly, the high priest remained stubborn. Pilate was scared, so he pretended to be strong, washed his hands, but we know what that's all about. He had the authority and didn't use it. And the crowd said, "Crucify him," because they were scared of what had happened to their kids if they didn't do it, and all the rest of this fear stuff that overcomes us still. And what does Jesus do when his heart is pierced? He doesn't run everything or control anybody. He just loves, because that's what God is. If we see that God respects human freedom, even when we obey as atrociously as people behaved in crucifying Jesus, and we've got to see it that way. If we see that Jesus' faith in God was not destroyed by the pain, the degradation, and the humiliation of the cross, we might dare to live the freedom that we're given, to love. Knowing our capacity to abuse freedom in our need and poverty, will humbly cry out, as Jesus did in his agony, knowing that God will grace us with his love. Purified by love and sensitive to the presence and action of God's loving Spirit in our lives, we'll dare to express love in the kind of creative self-giving that we see in Jesus, his hour of glory, on the cross. No one can stop you loving. No one can stop me loving. The only one who can stop us is ourselves. People can do things that hurt us, of course. People can make it very difficult for us to express love the way we'd like to, of course. They nailed Jesus to the cross. He couldn't do much, but he could still love. So can you, so can I. And God is love, so that's all we're asked to do. When it's said that Jesus must suffer, because it does say that in the scriptures a few times, in Luke's gospel particularly, he likes that. When it's said that Jesus must suffer, are we being told that we needed to see him love in the darkest place to shake us out of our lethargy and to save us from the futility of being caught up in a meaningless way of life in a desperate search for freedom in all the wrong places? If Jesus had have loved just in Galilee with a lamb around his shoulders and tripping through the wood and all very lovely, well then that would have been good. We would have been a good thing. Isn't he wonderful? And we would have loved to listen to his words. But then when we were on a cross, we'd think, well, it's okay. I like loving when it's easy, don't you? When it gets difficult is the problem. And we're taken back to the cross and we think, wow, apparently you can still love even when you're suffering. Even when you're crucified, you can still give yourself to others as best you can in love. Is that why we needed to see something? I mean, it's looking back and it's surmise, but I can understand Luke putting it that way. We needed to see something as drastic as this to wake us up to God's will that we love. We don't seek suffering, but if the only way to avoid suffering is to avoid loving, we've got Jesus' example to encourage us to love. And if your loving brings suffering upon you, and it will, and it does, then rejoice, says the Beatitude. Have that joy of the gospel that you'll be sustained with. His gift of the Spirit makes it possible for us not just to watch him and learn from him, but to actually do what he's doing in our agonies. On the cross, Jesus offered his life. He offered his love. He offered his very self to God and to us to draw us into communion with God. The kind of communion you can see there, that Mary and the beloved disciple have been drawn to the heart of Jesus and to the heart of his God. And the spirit between them is something quite astonishing and beautiful. And we've all been at deathbeds of people who are just lovely. We go away thinking they've gone straight to heaven, and we're probably right. I mean, they're just so pure. There's nothing left. But there's nothing left except love. And they're just there, accepting and ready and purified by suffering. And it's quite beautiful. To be in communion with God means to be made holy. That's what the word holy means. And there's the Latin, sacrum facere, from which we get our word sacrifice. Sadly, most people, most of the adult communities here, when they think sacrifice, they think slaying and blood. That's got nothing to do with it. You have to slay the animal to get the blood, which is a symbol of life. The sacrifice is the making holy, taking into the presence of communion with God. And that's the sacrifice of the Mass and the sacrifice of Calvary, is the making holy, drawing into a love communion with God. Let's look at suffering in the life of a priest. And I'll feel my way through it, and some of it might make sense to you and a lot of it mightn't, but